Okay, hi friends, and I'm finding a late hour to continue because I hope I have the energy for it. We are on commentary number 56, I do believe, or goodness, I hope I'm correct. Just going to see here quickly. 55, 56, no, it's 57. All right, so I'm glad that I checked with that. Oh, I see what's happened. Yeah, we're working with first ascertain the formula which will confine the lives within the ensphering wall. We've done that work. Then pronounce the words which will tell them what to do and where to carry that which has been made. And that's what we've been dealing with. The soul uttering forth the mystic phrase and becoming the controller of the lives. I've got a lot of notes in here. And what is causality anyway, and how the mental focus is necessary for real causality rather than just sort of a drift of circumstance, we might call it. And how often we're drawn into incarnation simply by the potency of the form and not by clear decision. And then later that changes. And here we are. Yes. And we're about to also enter some wonderful, rules. Well, what can I call them? I used to have a name for it, but they are the, councils. 15, let's say, 15 wise counsels that, again, I just have to recommend that you memorize. There's some wonderful lists of things here that we've been going over. One of them is the stages of man and the different colors that represent the stages, and the other, yeah, okay, well, maybe I'm more tired than I thought. Okay, so yeah, there's that, and yes, oh yes, very arcane commentary about the third initiation, which was used long ago in Atlantis, and I enjoy both of those very much. And now it's coming up the 15. I call them the wise counsels. Okay, so in a short time, we'll be doing that. In the lower human stages and in the stage of animal man, right, the same group activity reigns only as in the involutionary kingdoms, becoming smaller and smaller groups as the individual units achieve. All right, so when we begin to, certainly on the path of evolution, when we begin to leave the group as a true individual, the group becomes smaller. One by one, the status of truly self-conscious individuals and begin to work as souls. So then this is in the evolutionary arc. So let's just say this occurs in the evolutionary arc. As we're rising, and of course we rise in group form, and the group soul operates for quite a while, but when we become the human being, individualization looms ahead. And I suspect that the groups are larger in the mineral kingdom, a little smaller in the vegetable kingdom, a little smaller in the animal kingdom, and the smallest in the human kingdom, and depleted by the achievement of individualism by the individual units. They become truly self-conscious individuals, and they begin to work as souls, and then they distinguish themselves, and they, as it were, they leave the smaller. They leave the group units behind only to discover again, on a higher turn of the spiral, another form of group participation. So it's like an hourglass, you know. There's the unconscious group participation, then the stage of individuality or the expression more and more of the individual nature, and then a widening out into higher conscious and even superconscious group activity. Then they not only become creators with the power of standing alone. See, we can understand how that would be, right? The power of standing alone. Again, it's a first ray factor. First ray and Leo. And with the faculty of clear thinking and accurate visualization, but demonstrate also that they are the possessors of the creative art or faculty of creative imagination. So these abilities are added to the ever more individual man. Under the control of the soul increasingly. They pass through life after life of self-sufficiency in which the personality is developed and used, and I think we can say that the personality develops through the exercise of self-sufficiency. If we're always depending on others, we will never develop our faculties correctly. And our faculties will be no support for the heavier load that we will have to carry when we become souls within a group of souls as one soul. You think you're in the group, so you might not have to carry as much, but you carry even more, you know, as Master Moria says. Certainly he knows what it is to be in the kingdom of souls and beyond. Burden me still more as I enter the beautiful garden. So life after life and self-sufficiency is developed and used. And you might question, you know, for the moment, your own degree of self-sufficiency. How does it manifest? As DK tells us at one point, how much of the mountain of vision have you climbed on your own, or are you always dependent on the vision of others who have gone ahead of you? Well, he's certainly one of those giants upon whose vision we depend, but then there is the question, and you will know it when you are climbing the mountain of vision for yourself. So then they begin to find their subjective group, which will eventually take the place of the outer material groups in their consciousness, no matter how they may seem to be affiliated outwardly, it is the inner group which is the object of their attention. And thus they regain again group existence, on this time in full awareness and control rather than in the drifting and unconscious stage in which they were not yet really minds, you might say, and could not really then be causal agents. So in the group with which they find themselves subjectively affiliated, you know, just as those disciples, many of them coming into the arcane school and then chosen by the Tibetan on the basis of old association and long observation over the years, in the group with which they find themselves subjectively affiliated will be found those who have worked with them in the earlier mass state, so that they work in close association with those who have been nearest to them and who have been linked with them in the great life cycle. That's interesting. You know, I guess it takes a while to really develop relationships, and if we are constantly changing relationships as we progress, then maybe we are not really progressing in a deep manner. It's somewhat superficial, as we have to reestablish connections. That doesn't mean that we don't meet and work with people subjectively with whom we may not have had so much to do, but there is a tendency for families to stay together in the human stage and maybe to progress in the larger sense of family through the subjective spiritual stage. There are certain names given to these stages in the occult archives which are suggestive and illuminating, and they are, of course, symbolic. Let's just see here. I'm hoping, Well, friends, you know what I've done? I have. You may have remembered, you know, we've been told that the introduction to A Treatise on White Magic was so complex in a way that the readers and the editors printed it twice in a row without realizing they were doing that. And basically, I have just done the same thing. Okay? So I'm kind of reading this over, so I wonder if you noticed that you had heard it before. I have just made comment on what I commented upon before. So now we'll go to the right place. And because we did go through this about the different colors and of the different stages, I thought that was a really interesting section. Well, maybe a little repetition is not useless. I recognize, you know, I was on page 470 now, but why I didn't recognize it was that I didn't put any notes, any written commentary within those paragraphs about the different phases, the different color phases symbolized by color through which a man passes on the upward way. And so I thought maybe it wasn't done, even though I had left myself free to comment a little more freely rather than writing, and now I recognize it. So basically what is said here, you know, after he turns the cross over and he steps out beyond the cross, it's much brighter, not yet the utter glory of the radiant life, utter glory. And maybe, you know, where would that be found? Maybe on the way of higher evolution, progressively, until one reaches a very, very high stage. Not yet the entering into everlasting peace, and that, for me, can only happen at the Mahapralaya for a universe, but, you know, I'm not quite sure what he means there, but when I think about everlasting peace, I do think of the post-pralayic period. But still the work and still the lifting of the little ones, it seems that we always have one hand above and one hand below to receive inspiration above and to help below. So now I'm in the right place and only 14 minutes have been spent. Okay. Here in symbolic form, we have pictures of human life and progress, of life in form growing through the building process, which marks the creative work. See, the soul creates a personality which becomes creative as the soul is. And it's only a bald translation, he calls it, of some mantric phrases and of some basic symbols. I think we read that before, the idea of a bald translation, not really filled out, you know, that looks pretty good to me, and must in no way be considered to be anything except indicative of a process, veiled and couched so that only those who know can understand. Esotericists will understand that these five stages cover the life period of every form, no matter whether the creator is cosmic, planetary, or human. So there's always going to be a stage from a relatively crude state into one that is liberated for that particular arc of developing life. We will run when we become, let's say, members of the fifth creative hierarchy, we'll go through something similar. If we should become a ray on the way of high revolution or a planetary logos, a worker on the cosmic astral plane, we'll go through these stages as well, but they will be stages that are suited to the high level we have already achieved. Right. Okay, just want to check everything here. Every form is built by an impulsive spark of life, the monad. Okay. Emanated by a creator. Okay. Now, you know, here he's using the word that I love to use so much, and that is emanation or emanated. And, you know, I got it from somewhere. The Buddhist system of thought is filled with emanations. And growing stage by stage under the law of accretion. And you can apply this both descending, involutionarily, and ascending evolutionarily. Okay, involutionarily, yeah, involutional. Okay, right. An aspect of the law of attraction, which is the law of life. So he's saying basically, at least for us and on this planet and in this solar system, the law of attraction, the second law, the law of attraction sometimes and repulsion, is the law of life. This law cooperates with the law of cause and effect, which is maybe the sometimes they call, you know, the law of karma, the intermediate law of karma, which, as we know, is the law governing matter. Cause, attraction, or desire, accretion, and effect, these four words govern the construction of any thought form. In other words, we do not have such a form unless there is the accretion of the substance needed to fill out the form. When the latter is a completed entity, it is an effect built by accretion under the power of an organized cause. Now, you know, he gives us things to really ponder upon at this point. It has been set in motion by a cause. The cause is archetypal to it. It is therefore laid out in an organized manner. It has power, and the accretion, the matter, let's see, the accretion of matter follows the inner archetypal design. So every form is built by an impulsive spark of life. See, ultimately, that's going to be the monad, the central life. Maybe as we are upon the lower planes, we do not, you know, access the monad to build, but if we look deeply enough, that's what's there, the very fire of being at the heart of every, at the center of every causal agent. See, who are we anyway when you peel away the later layers? So, and growing stage by stage, and there is this thing called the law of accretion. There's a certain way that the matter is gathered into form. Matter is not form. Matter is gathered into form. The matter, you know, the tiny constituent lives that are arranged and pulled together under the influence of a greater geometrical arrangement. The race has now evolved, has evolved now to a point where we think of effects primarily in terms of quality rather than in terms of matter. And now this means that, let's just say, soul life is becoming more important and more noticeable. Yes, A, B, L, E. All right. So we're entering the qualitative stage, and, you know, when we begin to think about the fifth kingdom of nature, it's the kingdom of quality. You know, in Esoteric Psychology 1, he hammers that home all the time, the triplicity of life, quality, and appearance. And sometimes, you know, will and life are wrongly, I think, associated. But the will is so close to the life aspect. It's sort of the first expression, you might say. I always think of, you know, in a way, will, quality, and appearance, with life pervading them all, as Blavatsky tells us in her phrase or sentence that describes life, spirit, matter, and soul, and life pervading them all. Life is being, to me, anyway. That's how I think of it. All right, so a thought form exists for us to produce an effect. The raison d'etre of all forms we have come to feel, this, you know, you have to follow him word for word. The raison d'etre of all forms we have come to feel is to express some subjective quality which will give us the key to the Creator's purpose. Ponder on these words. You can just tell when a sentence is loaded. He doesn't always say ponder on this, but often he does. And when we feel that moment come when, oh, I have to pause here, something's really being said, maybe an occult hint is being offered to us. Maybe that is the case. If it stands out to us, it's an occult hint to be gathered out of the vast literature that is presented. No longer does the master, we are told, or the teacher say, now, here's a hint for you. You get your own hint, you know. And you will come to know where in the literature your hints lie. They will be arresting sentences that really get your attention. And you say to yourself, there's something in this for me. And then you ponder. Hence we find in this Rule 11 that the purpose of the word pronounced is to tell the lives which constitute the form what to do and where to carry that which has been made, because, you know, it's not going to stay there. It's going to precipitate, isn't it? It's going to densify. The accretion is going to help it, as it were, sink into lower spheres, which have a greater density. Thus, we find the idea of purpose, activity, and goal. The purpose is the archetype. The activity is the formation of the instrument of the purpose, and the goal is where that has to be placed. The formation of the instrument of the purpose and the goal, the context in which the form must reside and take up its life, its expression. And the purpose, well, you know, it is, let's just call it a purpose, an archetypal form. There is no need for me to add to the vast amount of literature which has been put forth, or to emphasize the significance of purpose in connection with such a thought form as a solar system, a planet, a kingdom of nature, or a human being. You know, well, for instance, our solar system acts as a heart center. No, not head center, please. Heart center in a cosmic logos. And our planet acts as a base of spine center in our solar system, informed by our solar logos. And on we can go. You know, a kingdom of nature will hold up a chakra position, and even in a little group, a human being can uphold a chakra position. When DK was designing those groups of nine, which looked like they had actually 12 triangles in them, but the central triangle had 3 points, and each point was in 2 triangles. So that's how he created a 12, which was a 9. The members of the central triangle were the head, heart, and throat, respectively, and he assigned them those roles, but not the others. So a chakric position tells us something about the function, something about the purpose. In some respects, this subjective triplicity of purpose, activity, and goal is well known, and in others, it is of too high and too inscrutable a nature for us to deal with in these instructions and wander into the realm of speculation, where I always live. Okay, so in some respects, it's okay, you know. We can see it in action. We seem to have a design in mind when we concentrate and attune, and we have to build an instrument to bring that design, which is from the world of being, let us say, into the world of becoming. So the activity is to build the vehicle, and then the goal is to place the instrument in the right context so it can fulfill a particular function below. With the goal, religion has long sought to deal with the activity aspect. The scientist is now attempting to deal, and with the will of God, the most advanced thinkers and philosophers are constantly speculating. You know, they're on the basis of what little they do know, they're trying to reach toward an understanding of what they do not know, and their method is often to use the law of analogy. But, you know, we ask the scientists, hey, how does it happen? How did this really come about? How was this instrument built within the overall garment of God? What were the motions of the constituents of the instrument with being built to serve the purpose. And then, of course, what can you do at this stage but speculate? You know, if you start talking about the one about whom naught may be said, or a galactic logos, or even a universal logos, far more, what can you do but on the basis of what you think is logical at this time and adheres to the laws of thought, you extend your thought towards such intangibles that you cannot possibly experience, but you maybe say something about them based upon analogy or the way the logic reaches ever higher and higher. I guess maybe in a way we call that abstract thinking, and it's better when it's fed by immediate realization of straight knowledge coming from the intuition. And I guess when it is straight knowledge, we really get the ring of it. You know, we talk about the ring of truth. We suddenly have that sense of coherence, which says, aha, this fits, this is true, this is confirmed, you know. Confirmation is a matter of resonance, really. And when we tell the truth and think the truth and speculate in as truthful a way as possible, we may come to that confirmation that we have rightly assumed something about the nature of a higher structure, a higher relationship, and it will ring true. Only when man submits himself to the discipline of his own spiritual will, you know, let's just say, we might say, coming from the sacrifice petals or from the atmic nature, sacrifice petals or the jewel in the lotus, or from the atmic nature, and controls the activity of the lives within his form nature, and so orients himself to the goal as it progressively makes its appeal to his vision, will he arrive at a true understanding of the plan, which constitutes the will of God as far as human beings can grasp it. And I think he's saying that human true understanding, okay, careful. All those things disappear, you know, then you get fragmented sentences. Human beings do not tend to understand the purpose, but part of the divine plan, yes, that is possible. Only when a man submits himself to the discipline of spiritual will. Well, you know, Vulcan, as a planet, is due to be discovered, and we know that the discovery of planets is timely. And that DK says something that a lot of people would consider to be outrageous, the planets name themselves. Well, for people who just think about the planets as a bunch of rock or gas in the sky, they're not going to be naming themselves. But if you think of the true inner being of a planetary body, then it's possible that the planet can name itself. So Vulcan will come at the time when we are ready to stand with massed intent, filled with the kind of spiritual will that will make the manifestation of the divine plan possible. How long will that be? Well, one gets the sense that Vulcan is due to be discovered. He certainly is evident in terms of the weaponry that we create and the way the scientific mind is prostituted to creating the instruments of death. Incredible weaponry. That's the realm of Vulcan, motivated by Mars. But with the thought forms which he is beginning to create as he daily learns to think, we can concern ourselves, for it is the first lesson soon to be learnt in the magical work. You know, so what is the quality of the thought forms which the human thinker thinks. We can concern ourselves with what the creator in mental matter does and what issues from his creative process. I suppose at the throat center, there's a big difference between creating semi-unconsciously through the rulership of the fecund earth and creating under Saturn or creating under Uranus in the seventh ray, which rules the throat center at a certain point. The creator in mental matter has to learn to build intelligently. The throat center is a center of intelligence, so is the Ajna center. And maybe everything in the head is to a certain extent. The throat center is a chakra of intelligence. To give the impulse through right speech, which will animate that which he has built, and so enable the thought form to convey the intended idea on its way, to manifestation. But it must be shared with others and in the right way. And then to send out his thought form correctly oriented to his goal and so truly directed that it will reach the objective and accomplish the sender's purpose. And this looks like this has in it the suggestion of an occult method. So to learn to build, that's the first here, and then to give the impulse through right speech, that's the next thing, because he has to generate enthusiasm for it. You know, sometimes you say, well, you talk up the idea, talk it up, you know, you make it appealing by what you say, and you motivate others to want to help in the materialization, because generally any thought form that's really worthwhile is going to take more than one person to bring it through, well, maybe bring it through, but then develop it and manifest it, and then to send out his thought form. That's the next, correctly oriented towards the goal. Now, for the magician, the goal is often very much appearance on the physical plane and in the right context, you know. That you have to send thought form to the right place, because you know how it is, if you're trying to do something that's appropriate only to a different place, you try to do it in a particular place, it's not the right place, it's not going to work. You have to find the right context. That can mean the right environment, the right people, you know, in which that form can be expressed. Okay, so we can think about thought form building, and that's what these councils that we're going to be studying in just a little while tend to deal with. The necessity for clear thinking and the elimination of idle, destructive, or he says, well, in the councils he talks about the idle thought, the selfish thought, the cruel, hateful thought, but this is the same idea. The necessity for clear thinking and the elimination of idle, destructive, and negative thoughts becomes increasingly apparent as the aspirant progresses on his way. You know, there's just certain thoughts you just don't want to entertain. You don't want to start them on the road to materialization. It takes a little discipline to cast away the habits of ages where you dwell in fear on negative possibilities, but it has to be done. As the power of the mind increases and the human being differentiates his thought increasingly from mass thought, he inevitably builds thought substance into form. I guess, you know, as we emerge as the thinker, We are also the builder, and what is the quality of what we build? That's the question. It is at first automatic and unconscious. You might say earth at the throat center. He cannot help so doing, and fortunately for the race, the forms constructed are so feeble that they are largely innocuous, or so in line with mass thought that they are negligible in their effect. So unconscious building, I guess he's saying unconscious building is not powerful, or usually not powerful. And it's an early stage. But as man evolves, his power and his capacity to harm or to help increases, and unless he learns to build rightly and correctly to motivate that which he has built, he will become a destructive agent and a center of harmful force. So power is neutral, and how is it used? Is it used with respect to the sensing of the plan of a creator greater than oneself, and in whom one lives and moves and has one's being? Or will there be a rebellion against such a creator? And some people, you know, sort of like cancer cells in a body, set themselves against the program and just want to grow in their own way and live predatorily, parasitically off the energies of the well-organized body. So they will become destructive agency and a center of harmful force, destroying and harming not only himself, as we shall see shortly in these councils, but equally hurting and harming those who vibrate to his notes. So let's just say that if we indulge in negativity, we harm not only ourselves but others. And we don't want to do that. You know, the destination of a harmful agent, and especially later a deliberately harmful agent, is not happy to contemplate. Granted all this, you might appositely inquire, are there some simple rules which the earnest and sincere beginner could apply to this science of building, and which are so clear and concise that they will produce the needed effect? Well, I call them counsels, but okay, I call these the 15 counsels. And the Tibetan calls them simple rules. Yes, there are, and I will state them simply so that the beginner, you know, who can be expected to be reading this book all unaware of its depth, but at least, you know, it's considered to be a foundational book, so there is that first pass, at least, concerning the book. There are, and I will state them simply, so that the beginner will, if he follows them, escape the dangers of black magic and learn to build in line with the plan. You know, no black magician or member of the counterforce is building in line with the plan. He's building for his own self-aggrandizement, and obviously he's just a tiny little expression of a greater energy. It's really a futile path, and that's why DK is calling them brothers of unique blindness. He will, if he follows the rules I give, avoid the intricate problem which he has himself blindly constructed. We might call this, in a way, the psychological equivalent, EQU, IV of the Gordian knot. Equivalent. How's that spelled? Equivalent. Okay, of the Gordian knot. And it's a tough one to untie or dissolve, and maybe you have to cut it. You know, there are different Ray approaches to dealing with the Gordian knot, and which will indeed shut out the light of day, darken his world, and imprison him in a wall of thought forms which will embody for him his own peculiar great illusion. So DK is just enjoining us. Just follow the rules I give and avoid a lot of misery later. Now this Gordian with an A. Now these rules, so many times I've read this particular section. These rules may sound too simple for the learned aspirant, but for those who are willing to become as little children, of course, that really means, you know, initiates of the first and second degree, but at least kind of attentive, they will be found to be a safe guide into truth and will eventually make them able to pass the tests for adeptship, that's masterhood. Some are couched in terms symbolic, and others are necessarily blinds, and still others express the truth just as it is. So, you know, maybe we'd have to discriminate there. Now, let's see what I do, because sometimes when reading these, I want the stream of my thought to flow along, and therefore writing with all of my liabilities and the spelling and the management of the keyboard and the rest gets in the way. So I might just, you know, speak what comes to my mind here. I've memorized these. I've forgotten them and memorized and forgotten them. You know, you have to use them or they will disappear. You have to reference them or they will disappear. But they are powerful. Just the way the six different stages or so, or the five symbolized by color, are powerful. And just the way that ancient Atlantean chant with its eight different sections relating to the realizations of the third degree, very powerful, very powerful. So let's take a look at these wise counsels, or as the Tibetan calls them, rules, or actually what he just as it is, he calls them simple rules, which will eventually make of one an adept. So they go very far, and they're not just for the beginner. I suppose for the beginner there is an application of them, but if you keep them going with appropriate application at each stage through which you pass, we will find that they are useful at a number of stages. Okay, then, let's begin and see what we think. Now, view the world of thought and separate the false out of the true. You are more than the mind. You are the observer. You are the soul in incarnation, and you can view your lower mind where things will be false or true or somewhere in between. When it comes to viewing the world of the soul, things are true, and you don't have to worry about that. This has to do with work within the personality, And we have to use the discriminative faculty. And the fifth ray is very useful here because it can cause cleavages. It rules the law of cleavages between what is false and what is true. If you build your life on falsity, if you accept falsity, if when you look at yourself, you don't accept a true picture, then there will be delay because you'll be building on false assumptions. So it's interesting that the fourth subplane of the mental plane is called discrimination. And here it is that you will be, discriminating largely between the personality and the soul. I don't know, maybe the fifth plane has a lot of the fifth ray in it. But we have to learn, you know, and few people do, what thoughts that I am carrying in my mental body are just illusory, not true, and what thoughts actually lead to greater light. So the false leads to darkness and generally serves the preservation of the personality just as it is, the personality that looks at itself as the king of beasts in a way. Well, others call it the king of beasts. We'll just say the king, and doesn't want to change, or the true, which leads to greater and greater light. Learn the meaning of illusion. Number two, learn the meaning of illusion, and in its midst, locate the golden thread of truth. I think there's a book that the Lucis Trust has published, it may be called the Golden Thread. It's not easy to learn the meaning of illusion. The great thought forms which control many human minds who are not thinking for themselves, so they simply go with the wrong perception of the mass consciousness. Ruled as it is, also by Kama, so the Kama monastic factor is very strong, and it's how you feel about a thought which determines whether you accept it or not, not whether it demonstrates truth on its own merits. But somehow, even though there is much distortion, there can be a glimmer of truth in the middle of it all, and that's what you have to find. Where can truth be found in this mass of misrepresentation, this mass of incorrect thought? And here's the thing, that once we find the truth, it is progressive. It will lead on to ever greater light, and we might even, you know, call the Antikarana in a way a golden thread. It will lead into the soul realms, and it will lead into the triadal realms, and probably eventually it will lead to the spirit itself. So, and you can help people with this. They may say something that's clearly incomplete, false, not true, and not necessarily that they're lying, they just don't know any better, but you can find some little thread of truth in that, and you can emphasize that and give that to the person as something to hold on to and to follow. And then the falsity in their formulation will fall away, and they can find their way into more expansive perspectives in which more and more truth can be found. But, you know, you have to be very attentive, because in a state of ignorance, people say all kinds of things and think all kinds of things. And you can't help them by just saying, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. You know, I mean, that's not how the Tibetan operated. He did point out, you know, certain things that needed changing, but he certainly wasn't negative about it. And he always found some encouraging factor that the student should emphasize, and which was true enough to lead to greater truth, greater light, greater release. So this is it's kind of how you treat the knowledge thread, you know, and the consciousness thread. We are surrounded by misleading feelings and thought forms which poorly interpret reality or represent reality. How do we find our way out of this mess? Of course, if the heart is open, we will, through love, see. The heart has eyes, you know, and when there is the real heart opening, it's on the way to the intuition, and the intuition is straight knowledge and straight sight. I mean, we can work with logic to get ourselves out of the tangle, out of the jungle of illusion, I guess. The jungle of illusion is set on in flames, something, and the path stands clear or free. It's the fire in Aries that can help to burn up the jungle in illusion. I didn't quote it exactly correctly, but it's a beautiful idea, and I said it to a song actually once in the Aries ritual. And the path stands clear and free. But if we're just about trying to figure out what glamour is, you know, illusion is that much harder, and there's not that many people who are yet at the mental stage of perception, where they have to worry more about illusion than they do about glamour. But maybe, you know, the disciples and the students of esotericism have, many of them, I'm sure, moonshine types, have been at it longer and have a lot of third ray, perhaps, and have to deal with illusion until they can think for themselves with truth. Number three, control the body of emotion. For the waves that rise upon the stormy seas of life engulf the swimmer, shut out the sun, and render all plans futile. It's hard to reason with a person. It's hard to get at the truth of the person who is in an emotional turmoil. And the condition of the astral body blocks the truth. Sometimes, of course, you know, you have a secondary astral body, maybe it's a little easier to see the truth than an aroused sixth-ray astral body, but there's fear in the secondary astral body, and that also can prevent the clear seeing of the truth. So, well, it doesn't say suppress the body of emotion. It, you know, there has to be a more delicate way of handling it. You have to use, I think, the breath to handle it. The power of visualization, you have to uplift it. You have not to sink into the activity of the solar plexus, but keep your focus as the observer and stay in the higher chakras. Perhaps if one stays in the heart is not so much the seat of emotion, it's the seat of a deep feeling, as a Moria dignifies that word feeling, you know, in his books. So when we can focus in the higher chakras, you know, Ajna and head and so forth, and heart, and even the mentality of the throat, and really substitute efforts along those lines for an immediate descent into the turbulent emotions, we will keep the astral body calm, and the modifications of the lower nature, as given by Patanjali, will not rise up and distort and hide and conceal. It all depends, you know, to a degree, what we do with our mind, and sometimes air and water create the storms. We've been having a lot of hurricanes lately, and it's a combination of wind and water under certain circumstances. And the warmer the water lately, as the temperature has been rising dangerously, the more severe the storm. So we have to be able to be cool about our emotions. Of course, I'm not a good one to speak, you know, having fire signs and a six for astral body, but we have to be we have to be cool and silent, to will, to know, to dare, and to be silent. We don't let the lower elementals speak up too much. We don't necessarily hold them with an iron grip and strangle them. There has to be a way that they are nourished and led more and more into responsiveness to the higher energies. And there's all kinds of upsetting things in life. And it depends, do we react or do we respond? If our first reaction is to react, then there will be turbulence and blindness, and we will lose our sight because the stormy waters will get in the way of seeing clearly. The waves that rise upon the stormy seas of life, when blown by certain types of thoughts, so we have to keep our thought in a positive place, away from worry and negativity and all that that can whip up the emotions. And we are the swimmer. We are on our way to, we're crossing the water in a way. You know, with Capricorn, maybe it's easier. There's a lot of control there. We're crossing the water to, get out of the water and then into the fires and toward the veiled and hidden door of initiation. But the soul, the sun, is shut out, and the mind, the soul illumined mind, the potential for that is shut out, and you cannot carry plans through when they can be disrupted by any random emotional impulse. So, you know, it's not the emotional people of life who really, you can have a strong astral body. It's not that. I mean, DK says that artists have a rich astral body, or should. But if you're just led by your emotions, they're extremely changeable. And we cannot stay on the path towards realization of our intentions. The mind will cease to control, and the soul will cease to control the mind. The soul-infused mind is hidden, it's shut out, and it's dark and it's glamorous, and it doesn't lead anywhere. So control the body of emotion. The breath will help. The uplifting via the breath of the lower energies into the heart response, let's say, for the waves, in that watery sphere that rise upon the stormy seas of life, because there are so many disturbances potentially, engulf the swimmer. And an engulfed swimmer can't stay on top of water, you know. You're drowning beneath the waves, and it's not a pleasant prospect. Shut out the true guidance of the soul, the sun, and because there is no guidance, the plans are futile. There's guidance, but you just can't register it in an emotional condition. Now, early on, number four, discover that thou hast a mind and learn its dual use. I think I remember when I recapitulated discovering that I had a mind. It was a philosophy exam at the university. And I think I didn't study well that year or that semester, and a lot of things I didn't know. And we stayed up all night. In those days, you took no dose, just caffeine, stay awake. And I inched a little closer to comprehension, but I knew it was going to be an exhausting, demanding test, and I wasn't prepared. And I went into it, and I just looked at the questions, and I said, well, I don't remember much about this, I said, but what do I think? What do I think? And then I began to think in my own way about how one could answer these questions. It was a totally different process than kind of, oh, that's what the teacher said. Oh, yeah, I'll write that down and take notes. In after lunch history class, you know, many are the trails of the sentences as one sort of falls asleep and wakes up again and starts writing legibly. But it wasn't what the teacher said. It was what I thought. So in a way, you know, in this life, and at that time, I have the acute memory of discovering that I really had a thinking mind and I could come up with it on my own. And then we have to learn its dual use, as we can in Scorpio particularly, because it can reflect the soul and become the soul-infused mind, but can also control the lower vehicles. So it works, it's Janus in a way. It's got two faces. It's going to look above, it's going to look below. Especially when you know there is a pair of opposites, higher and lower. So, you know, what's going on in the world of the soul, and can the mind record it? And then how does it apply to the lower environment? And we need the mind, of course, to sometimes see the distortion and illogic of our emotions. And also, we train our body through the use of the mind, too. It's a mental game, as we've often been told. A lot of people, well, I don't know if it's really true, but they discover that when they exercise mentally or through imagination, involves the astral body, they seem to get the benefit from exercise, even though their body is not moving. So the mind is very powerful to control that which is below and very open under right circumstances to receive the energy from above. Discover that thou hast a mind. You know, DK says, well, we say to the children of the race, if you will only think, if you will only use your mind, you know, instead of just sort of chaotically feeling your way through life with lots of highs and lows and inappropriate reactions and dramatic reactions, all that kind of thing. He says, we say that to the children of the race. I guess I felt like one of the children of the race at that moment. But, you know, we do recapitulate as we go through our early life, some of the various stages through which we had passed long ago. I felt that was a recapitulation because the mind was ready to act. And I had never used it in that way. And then I began to have a new trust in it. What do I think, you know? And then, you know, when it came to write this infinitization book years and years later, I said, I'm not going to read books to write this book. I'm going to say, what do I think, you know? And I became dependent on myself more and more. I mean, maybe there's a little book called The Crest Jewel of Discrimination, Viveka Kudamani. I flashed a few glances at that, but it was written on my own. And I think, you know, DK asks us, how much of the mountain of vision have you climbed for yourself? And Ralph Waldo Emerson writes about self-reliance, and he just says, well, there comes a time in everybody's life when you realize that imitation is kind of a slavery. So anyway, you know, apply it how you will, but there's a difference between repeating what you've heard from a well-known source, and I do it all the time. I mean, I think Master DK is wonderful and Master Mori is wonderful, okay, but there's also your own determination of the truth, if you can. Now, number five is kind of interesting. You know, it's kind of interesting you enter the realm of the pairs of opposites at the fourth petal. You know, you kind of wonder whether there's a code underlying some of these sentences, because I just looked at number five, and it's very Leo, fifth sign, concentrate the thinking principle and be master of thy mental world. That's what Leo can do. And when we look at the stages of meditation, Leo begins it all with concentration. Then comes meditation, then contemplation, then illumination, then inspiration, then initiation. And I've extended, you know, universalization and identification. Couldn't find that for Aquarius. I couldn't find the I word. Maybe I didn't spend long enough for it. But DK provides these mnemonics for us with triple letters. Or, you know, if it's four things in a row or five things in a row, they all begin with the same letter. So, you know, you hold it in mind. But there is such a thing as the diffuse mind, which is not terribly focused and therefore not very good at producing a point of tension or working with a point of tension for the sake of penetration. Focused, immovable will is what a point of tension is called, and we had better focus the mind and use the will through that focused mind, and then we can penetrate into possibilities that lie behind the kind of vague registering of what's going on with an unfocused mind. So we've learned there is a mind, and we've learned now that at a certain point of tension it can penetrate for the sake of acquiring a greater knowledge. And it may be the lower mind, but this concentrated thinking principle, you know, of Leo, it says, let other forms exist, I rule. Well, okay, it's a kind of a egotistical mantra, but from another point of view, Leo is the ruler. Leo is the fifth sign. It has the fifth ray. It represents the illumined lower mental world. It also represents much more, of course, and be the master, as the king is ever the master. Leo is the king, and control the flow, the direction, the formulations, the sequence in your mental body. Control it, whatever it means to be a master of your mental world. You're not going to be a master of the higher mind yet, but you can be a master of the lower mind. So, you know, sometimes say, now let's really think. Let's really get into this. Let's now let's concentrate and see really what we come up with. And when we do, you know, DK says you can accomplish a lot more in just a few hours than you might in years of non-penetrative thinking, of not being able to hold the proper penetrative point of tension. Is a bit like a laser light. And you know, you can use lasers to destroy obstacles, destroy matter. I mean, you know, laser weapons are coming and they're already being experimented with. I suppose all the big nations, you know, China, Russia, United States, I don't know who else, but they've got their laser arsenal. But basically, the many thoughts within the mind prevent access to higher truth, and we have to go through them. So, you know, there is that statue of the thinker, and that's a picture of concentrating the thinking principle and shutting other things out so that one can receive from a level of vibration which is not to which one has not been accustomed. Concentrate the thinking principle and be master of thy mental world. See, all of this is about thought form creation, isn't it? That's what DK was saying. We can't talk about the too intelligently about the creation that the solar angel brings to pass, or how it does it, or and even less about the planetary logos, and even less about the solar logos, and on. We can't reach into those creative enterprises. But in terms of thought form building, we can make a change in how we do things so that we're much more effective. Number six, learn that the thinker and his thoughts, and that which is the means of thoughts, are diverse in their nature, yet one in ultimate reality. Now, we're making some progress here. Because, you know, that concentration is very Leo, and Virgo comes in for meditation and for discrimination, and we do learn under Virgo in a way that there is a thinker, there is a mind, which is the means of thought, and there is the thought itself. We discriminate, but in Libra, we put it all together, meaning that Libra is the sign of contemplation. And in contemplation, the subject and the object become one. Now, I think we should all try it. And Alice Bailey gives a wonderful description of how that is done in, if you really want to get into the meditative process, from intellect to intuition, it's just a great book. You know, as usual, I said, I just want to read the Tibetans books. But then I read what she wrote and I said, this is really helpful. And when trying to teach meditation, you will find that referring to from intellect to intuition is really helpful. And I suppose all of her books are, as she said, I had to write them, just to prove that I too, had a brain. I mean, she's humorous, No one doubts that she has a brain, a powerful mind. How else could you work with a Tibetan without crumbling? But one finds one is the being, the thinker. I think that Master Moria assigning names as he likes to do meant Plato when he called one of the characters he describes as the thinker. And the materialist, I think, was Sigmund Freud, I think. And the lion, interestingly enough, I think he was the Buddha. Master Moria uses symbolism a lot, and pictorial representation and a lot of beauty. I mean, fourth ray in his makeup, certainly as Solomon and whoever else he was, fourth ray was strong. A little divergence there, but I'm the thinker, I'm the being, I'm the creator. I work in mental matter, I have a thought. But the process by which I work in mental matter with my mental capacities is that which is the means of thought. And they work in different ways. One is very central. And the other is mobile. And yet another produces an object. There's an activity producing an object, and it's done by a centralized being who has capacity to use the powers of the mind. And yet, when you begin to realize in contemplation that somehow there's an identicality flowing through all of this, I think the subject-object unification is among the most important things we can do to look at anything. We might start with other people and find the sameness between what you really are and what they really are. There may be qualitative differences, but you just work at a level below, within those qualitative differences. Then you might extend it to other kingdoms of nature. It doesn't make any difference what you see, what is the power, what is the quality of what you see. There is a sameness, which I use the word, I say, which infusception reveals. So we've taken a leap here. We've learned really to control the mind. We have a mind. We concentrate the mind, we penetrate with the mind, we penetrate in such a way that the barrier between ourselves and others is breached. You know, I am I and you are you, such a Leo thing, but Libra shows the commonality between the subject and the object. So practice that with another human being. It doesn't have to be there, you know, just the image of, or with anything at all. Negating the quality of the thing, whether it's good or it's bad, negate the quality for a moment, and you will find the sameness of yourself as that sameness in the other. And thus we overcome a pair of opposites on the horizontal level, and we're on our way to overcoming the illusion of separateness, the great heresy of separateness. So a lot of this is about thinking, isn't it? And that's what he said. We would learn to pay attention to the thought forms we are creating, and we can deal with them. It's important we're not going planetary, systemic, cosmic when we do this. We're right down here in the microcosm, but it's really important that we do that. Act as the thinker rather than the feeler and the actor, you know. Plunge ourselves into Maya as the busy, thoughtless type, and plunge ourselves into constant reaction, the reactor rather than the thinker in the astral body. Act as the thinker and learn it is not right to prostitute thy thought to the base use of separative desire. We really learn what a power thinking is, and it's meant to be a creative power consecrated to the manifestation of the divine plan. So, you know, we hold a mental focus. That doesn't mean that all of us are necessarily yet mentally polarized. That's a special case arising during the interval between the second and third initiation, and I believe we kind of prove it by our experience in the desert. When we think, you know, from that time on, the soul is guiding through the mind. And then we're on the Syrian path of initiation, and we can take the third degree instead of veering off on the path of selfishness, the left-hand path, which confines our sense of identity to much less than the identity really is. So when we tread the left-hand path, we're putting ourselves in prison, really. And when we think positively, the achievement of positivity is the goal of the initiate on the second ray. I think it's page 507 of Rays and the Initiations, right around there. Positivity. Under all circumstances, the inner and higher power prevails, and not the worried attitude of one who fears being overcome by the environment and so forth. So we could advance our negative desires. You know, we still might have desires that are not good for us, ourselves, and not good for anyone. And we can use our intelligent mind to see to the attainment of those desires. But that is base, that is low, that is not where we can be led through the right use of the mind. So we cannot use a faculty in an area where it should not be used. You know, like prostitution, using the sexual power simply for gratification and not for its original purpose, it's the reproduction of the race. And so that leads nowhere, really. It might be some, you know, for a while, some psychological healing in it and all that for some people, but it's using a faculty which is meant to be used at a higher level and using it at a lower level. So the mind is meant to reflect the soul and arrange for soul objectives to be manifested. It's not meant to aid and abet the fulfillment of low desire. And there are many clever people who are selfish, and they want selfish things. The whole Black Lodge is filled with that, with extraordinary mentality of a concrete kind, and they really, what they want is self-aggrandizement, you know, rising and dominating all. It's a very ugly thing, and they use the power of the mind, which they have cultivated, for that negative purpose, and it just has to be rejected. And this amplifies it, number eight. The energy of thought is for the good of all and for the furtherance of the plan of God. Use it not, therefore, for thy selfish ends. Well, you know, separative desire is all about selfish objectives. In Atlantis, we learned that the relatively infant race, young race, was fed with all kinds of inflammatory desire, so that the desire nature, we might say, swelled far beyond its intended purpose and began to seek after things which were absolutely luxurious and not necessary. Now, I know the word lux or light is in luxury, but it's a bit like fool's gold. It's not the real thing. It may glitter in your mind, but it's not real. So now we're thinking about group consciousness. The mind, the soul infusing it increasingly, as the light comes into the mind and into the brain, and you use it for everybody. It's going to be the advancement of some aspect of the plan, which will eventually spread around the world and be good for everybody. I mean, you know, when Edison worked on that filament, what did he say? Now we know what? He said, well, you've tried all these things. What the number 900 is sticking in my mind, but probably not right. But let's just say, for the sake of illustration, you've tried 900 things and you haven't found it. Don't you think you should give up? And he says, no, now we know 900 things that don't work. And so we've narrowed the field and we are ready to discover what does work. So when someone like Edison invents the light bulb with the filament, it's all over the world. It increased the illumination for all mankind eventually, maybe except in the deepest jungle, and more that's being overcome. So thought, soul-guided thought, is for the general good, and if it's for the general good, it's in line with the plan of God. So don't use your thought to connive and plan and plot so that you can achieve your selfish objectives. You know, alcoholics hide their bottles. Everybody knows that, and they get really good at it, and they use their mind to think about being discovered or not discovered, and they think their way to find a good hiding place. You see, obviously there's a desire there that must not be indulged, because it destroys the drinker and it destroys, harms those around the drinker. And if you use your mind in that way to plot and plan, thieves can be very, very intelligent. You know, maybe some of you have had the experience of being stolen from and how they go about it. And there's a lot of intelligence. It's even a genre in the movies, the heist movies, you know. How do we pull off this Mission Impossible of a theft as if it's a riddle to be solved, you know. But that's the use of the lower mind for an unworthy objective. So the energy of thought is for the good of all and for the furtherance of the plan of God. Use it not, therefore, for thy selfish ends. And then, before a thought form is by thee constructed, assuming the, you know, deliberate, more deliberate method of construction rather than just a spontaneous, irresponsible bringing of a thought form into existence. Before a thought form is by thee constructed, vision its purpose, ascertain its goal, and verify the motive. So now we're really at a more powerful mental stage. The mind can be used as a constructive agent and for good or for ill. So it's like thinking before you speak. It's like pausing even before you think. So you are in alignment with something which will guarantee the quality of what you're about to create or receive. You know, align with the soul before a thought form is by thee constructed. Except for the most mundane kind of things, you know, which you just habitually know how to carry out. Before a thought form is by thee constructed, vision its purpose. What is its archetype? What design does it have? And in the larger context, what does it mean? What is its significance? This is a higher estimation. But then see where that thought form is going to be directed, where it lands. What is the outer context of it when it precipitates? And then the central factor is, why do you want this thought form you are constructing, which is supposedly in line with the purpose? Why do you want it to exist? Why do you want it to go to a certain context? Why do you want it to fulfill its goal? Is your motive high? Is it helpful? Is it selfish? So submit to truth, verify truth, verify the motive. Because, you know, two people may do the same thing, and even with equal success, but what is impelling them to do those things in the same way, the same thing? What is impelling them? For one, it may be a selfish act. For another, it may be a selfless act. So, first of all, you know, be careful about the alignment before deliberately creating a thought form, and visualize in the precipitation process into what lower or outer context it will be directed and find itself, and then why. What are you trying to achieve? What do you really want by doing this? You want the welfare of the whole? Do you want some elevation of your own personality? Do you want to compete with somebody? You know, there's all kinds of motives behind. Sometimes I've reached ahead, you know, like with the new esoteric schools, and I was interpreted as being ambitious. You know, and it seemed an outrageous thing, and people just looked at what I was doing and said, okay, it's just ambition driving him. But I knew better that this was the word of the master, and some steps, at least however wanting in completion, had to be taken to advance the whole process of moving towards a higher standard of education. I knew that within myself. The ambitious part just didn't fit. There's all kinds of ways of being ambitious. I wasn't doing it for myself. The master spoke, he predicted, he said it must emerge, and even now, 100 years ago, beginnings were being made. I said, well, we've got to take it a step further. So I thought in that instance I verified the motive, and but we have to look honestly at ourselves. Are we looking for recognition, that third factor that must be destroyed in Rule 11 for disciples and initiates? Anything that seeks the inner or outer recognition or acclaim? Are we looking for that? Or is there more alignment with the divine plan and a degree of selflessness involved in it? As ever, when you work with the divine plan for the divine plan, there will be sacrifices and a degree of selflessness will be required. So, before a thought form is by thee constructed and deliberately constructed, vision, you know, it might almost say its archetype, vision, its purpose, its form in the Platonic sense, capital F, you know, the realm of forms. We're not talking about precipitated forms, we're talking about formless forms. Vision, its purpose in the larger context, always. Ascertain its goal, its place in the outer context, and just check about why you're doing that, and do it truthfully. Okay, number 10. Now we, you know, are getting into the emotional body, I guess. Well, it's kind of chemomonastic. The emotional body is involved in all of these things, but it has a big role to play in the person who is thinking. Because we are not free of chamomanus, you know. Carl Jung, I think, you know, as a psychologist, he called them feeling-toned thoughts, something of that nature. You know, they carry the matter of desire with them. They're not totally antiseptic. They're not totally clear of the desire element. Maybe they never should be entirely. For thee, the aspirant on the way of life, the way of conscious building is not yet the goal. And yet, in the one rule before that, we are constructing thought forms, but maybe this is telling us what we have to do before we are much engaged in the construction of thought forms. The way of conscious building, deliberate building, is not yet the goal. It will be. The work of cleaning out the atmosphere of thought, of barring fast the doors of thought. You know, just this is really closing the door on certain types of energies, barring fast the doors of thought to hate and pain, you know, self-pity, suffering, and all that, to fear and jealousy. These are all incapacitating anti-relational states. To fear and jealousy and low desire must first precede the conscious work of building. And then the warning, see to thy aura, O traveler, on the way. Well, we are the aspirant, and aspirants are of many levels, and we are aspirants to true discipleship and to the path of probationary initiation, and eventually to the path of what is called real initiation. For thee, the aspirant on the way of life, the way of conscious building, you know, setting oneself aside and say, okay, now I'm going to formulate and empower thoughts which I want to send forth, and they're going to have an effect. We may not be ready to do that. Why? Because we may still be living in a dirty, fairly filthy, rather compromised thought atmosphere. You know, have we, DK tells us, the churches and political groups, just reflections of the minds of the people in there, have to clean house. And we have to, through the telling of the truth and thinking of the truth first, be pure in fiery in our thoughts. So first we have to get rid of the negativity in our own thought process. It seems obvious, doesn't it? But one is not going to be on the road to adeptship, getting more and more powerful in thought with a lot of negativity running around the mind. Clean it out, bar fast the doors of thought. Don't even let it in when it's, don't admit. Some people think you have to let everything in. But you get a feeling about what's trying to come in, and you know it's going to do you or no, anybody else no good. So barring fast the doors of thought to hate, antipathy, rejection, dispersal, and pain, thinking about poor me. You know, one is first ray and the other is on the second ray. We can't always be dwelling on our misery, can we? Even though Master DK tells us we have the habit of misery. So barring fast the doors of thought to hate and pain, to fear, which always keeps us from going through and from confronting that through which we must pass. And so we are kept in a prison of our own making through fear. And fear is the great dweller on the threshold for the majority at this time, to hate and pain, to fear and jealousy, which keeps us in a rivalry with our fellow aspirants and disciples with whom we should be having good and loving relationships. But the jealousy factor enters and poisons our relationships and kills the loving unity which should exist, and in general, low desire, wanting to follow the path of pleasure, wanting to indulge the hydra, you know, sex, money, and comfort. Let's indulge those. And fear, it's okay, you know, to be afraid. Fear, hatred, and ambition. I want power over others, you know. And then maybe one would not sanction these, but one just has developed oneself that way. Pride, separativeness, and cruelty. When you are under the influence of those, you don't necessarily stop and say, hey, they're not good for me, or they're not good for anybody. So you've got to shut these things out. We all do. And when we kind of feel them coming, I sometimes feel what could be like a rising sense of pride. And immediately my inner monitor just gives me a flash and says, no, we're not going in that direction. I just feel the danger of it, even before it has formed any kind of thoughts. And maybe it's a Masonic thing, you know, the sort of the soul conscience, you might say. Something is watching over you and signaling to you when the path is clear and you can pursue it, and signaling to you when you may be treading a path which is separative and dangerous and against the plan. So, you know, I'm more and more aware when the touch of something that is not wholesome, you know, doesn't lead to wholeness, begins to arise in the psyche. So let's clean it out before we really get consciously working at building, because otherwise our building is going to be tainted and it will poison others. And obviously, we don't want that. So there's some house cleaning to do, and maybe, you know, when we're raised in such a way with a lot of Virgo or whatever, where we really have to learn how to manage the house and clean the house, we're having a preliminary lesson in what's necessary when we deal with our own psyche. I wonder, tell me when I fall asleep if I'm channeling here something. It's getting late, but I do want to finish this. this section, okay? And then, of course, the warning, the aura, the radiation that comes from the quality of the thoughts and feelings and even action tendencies that we entertain within our energy system. That's our aura, and see to it. Observe it. Be truthful about it. Notice what's going on. Oh, traveler on the way. Otherwise, you won't get very far. So it's very preliminary, but I've seen people quite advanced on the path who still have those areas. Maybe we all know about ourselves, you know, still have those areas that have to be cleaned up. And this carries on in the same vein, number 11, watch close the gates of thought. So how much vigilance is needed, you know? Watch close the gates of thought, sentinel desire, cast out, these are dramatic gestures, cast out all fear, all hate, all greed. Look out and up. He once counseled a disciple who had failed, you know, tears streaming down your face, look toward the sun and raise your face to the light. But look, it's this vigilance factor. We can go through life in a myopic, fairly unconscious manner, ignorant of what's passing through our mind, not the observer, or we can actually do many things at the same time. Do what we're doing, but keep up one's guard about the quality of what enters into one's psyche. And you know how it is, the sentinel is walking on the wall in the old days, and it's not just enough to have a nice high wall protecting you against attack, but those vigilant eyes have to see whether any kind of attack is coming from without. But of course, the attack can come from the quality of desire that passes through your desire body. So don't let low desire pass. You know, thou shalt not pass. You will not pass, said Gandalf to the Balrog, I guess. This great ancient demon. Boy, Tolkien really had something about the astral plane going. He knew it, Middle Earth, you know. Anyway, be sharp, be vigilant, and ready and alert not to let pass those desires which just qualitatively don't belong in your desire body anymore. Maybe in the beginning one could understand it, but when you're an aspirant, becoming a disciple, you've got to have a qualitative guard about which passes through your astral body. And then quite a bold action to cast out is to throw away. It's like really throwing. You don't just say, no, come on, fear, just move a little, get. No, you throw it out. You throw away hate. You throw away greed, which is indulging the desire body and not having faith in life. You know, you've got to accumulate whatever it is that's of value to protect yourself from outer possibilities. You think you are more and better when you have a lot. So greed is meant to aggrandize the little self. You see it, you throw it out. This is not a gentle gesture. This is, you know, we used to have something called the ball throw in gym. And you take that softball and just see how far you can really throw it. And you develop what's called an arm. You know, every pitcher needs a good arm, but everybody was involved in the ball throw. You throw it away and get it out of your range, get it away from you. Of course, maybe we will be accountable for where we throw it, you know, but at least for the moment, clear out your own energy system. Because fear will cripple you through non confrontation. You just won't face the things that have to be overcome. And hate will destroy the possibility of unity, and greed will lead to a glut and lack of circulation and separation between you and others, and the privation of those others while you have more than you need, which will, in a way, create a condition of non-circulation. You know, so much money, he didn't know what to do with it. Accumulated too great an accumulation. The motive was fear and self-aggrandizement. And instead of kind of brooding about things, look out so you can help. Look out and look up for inspiration. You want to apply a certain purity that you now have to the service of those who are out there. Of course, when you think about the astral mental plane, they're subtle bodies, and in a way, they're not yet subjective. So maybe you can call them out. But, you know, look at the world. It needs help. And look up for inspiration. Watch, close the gates of thought, sentinel desire, cast out all fear, all hate, all greed. Look out and up. Number 12, because the life, thy life, is mostly centered on the plane of concrete life, such is our development at this stage, thy words and speech will indicate thy thought, because words and speech are a precipitation at a certain point of saturation of thought. So again, watch it. You know, watch, be alert, vigilant. To these, pay close attention. When we can achieve the third degree and be centered within the causal body, it's another matter. But we're still living the concrete, semi-personal life, even though perhaps some soul energy is coming in. Because the life is mostly centered on the plane of concrete life, not exclusively so, but the concrete mind and the concrete astral body and all that holds thy attention, then watch what you say. Thy words and speech will actually show what you've been thinking. There's such an immediate link. It's inconceivable that you're, when you speak, it's not backed up by some kind of thought which is similar to the speech. So watch your thought and watch your speech as a result of that thought. And make sure that it is of a certain quality which reflects the higher energies. Otherwise, you're going to be separative in your speech and work against the divine plan. The control of words, learning what occult silence is, and it's not what we normally think it is, go to Rule 11 and the fourth of four preliminary preparations. Occult silence, what is it? It's not silent thinking, he tells us. Okay, so go there and find out. We're concrete beings, pretty much. And especially, he says, this takes the aspirant to where the aspirant needs to go. Now, maybe some of us have passed through the stage and maybe we're disciples now, but we're all of us aspiring to higher possibilities. Anyway, we have to move from the concrete to the abstract without losing touch with the concrete and being able to manipulate and work with the concrete in such a way that's helpful. So what are you really thinking? Maybe it's sometimes easier to observe what you say than it is to observe fleeting thoughts. Anyway, just be aware that what it is that you say has a very close connection to what it is that you think and observe. Don't just let that mind wander. Observe and see what is the product, the speech product of your thought. And then he goes on to describe what kind of speech we're dealing with. So we're getting near the 2 hour mark, but I am going to go on and finish this. I just feel that it is necessary to do so, and this is already the 17th because it's after midnight here. So we'll be ending number 57 and being ready to start on the 58th on the 17th of September. Okay. Number 13. Speech is of triple kind. This is a long one. The idle word will each produce effect. If good and kind, naught need be done. If otherwise, the paying of the price cannot be long delayed. Thought, speech, karma. There is a connection. It all begins with sow a thought, reap, sow a thought, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap character. Sow character, reap destiny. Character is destiny. And it all starts with thought. So if otherwise the paying of the price cannot be long delayed, this, now he differentiates. The next phase, the selfish word sent forth with strong intent, selfish words, build up a wall of separation. Long it takes to break that wall and so release the stored up selfish purpose. See to thy motive. You know, all of this is seeing to, watching, being vigilant, being alert, being mindful. We can't, as disciples, even aspirants, go through life drifting and unaware. See to thy motive and seek to use those words which blend thy little life with the large purpose of the will of God. So cautiously speak. Then, even more intense, the word of hate, the cruel speech which ruins those who feel its spell, the poisonous gossip passed along because it gives a thrill. These words kill the flickering impulses of the soul, cut at the roots of life, and so bring death. If spoken in the light of day, just retribution will they bring. When spoken and then registered as lies, they strengthen the illusory world in which the speaker lives and holds him back from liberation. If uttered with intent to hurt, to bruise, and kill, they wander back to him who sent them forth, and him they bruise and kill. So this is the longest rule, and he differentiates the idle word from the selfish word from the cruel, hateful word. Even the idle words produce effect, and we do know that there are people that just talk, and they don't care what comes out of their mouth, they just talk. They just exercise the throat center, not for any purpose. And many things come out, and it's fairly innocuous often, but it does fill the air, so to speak, with thought forms, and it may be difficult to deal with all that triviality. You know, he tells one disciple that you have the glamour of circumstance, a lot of petty thoughts that you have to deal with, and petty circumstances, and they just hold you down and prevent you from really penetrating into higher levels of thought. So they will produce an effect, but if they're just not harmful, you don't have to do much, except if you want to really advance on the path of speech leading to initiation, then you have to rein it in, you know. And you have to transform the sort of earth rulership of the throat center into the Saturnian disciplined rulership. And then eventually there'll be a Uranian rulership where your words will be magical and they will precipitate and they will bring the plan closer. But if they're not good and kind, they will produce an effect and you will pay the price. And it won't be long either. And the price will come to you. I'm just realizing some karmic circumstances I've been in through wrong speech at certain points, and then I didn't kind of trace it. Something happened much later where I was the victim of the wrong speech of others, and it was related. So sometimes it's hard to trace the karmic threads, but speech is to be attended to, and he says in the right volume and the right tonality, and you know, and that he who masters speech is close to initiation. Now, the selfish words are going to emphasize your own little lower ego, and if you really emphasize your selfishness, sending those words forth with strong intent, like, you know, I'm the greatest. There's so many different ways to say, I'm the greatest, and we're witnessing it now in a horrifying and amusing way at the same time. The selfish words that just emphasize your importance, you know, or the nationalistic words, my country is the greatest, all for the wrong reasons, of course, just egotistical reasons, they just separate you from the others of your kind, naturally. If you're always emphasizing how good you are, you sometimes have to emphasize how bad the other guy is. You put him down, you know. We see that all the time. I'm great and you are small. It's almost like a dynamic which has to exist if you're going to exaggerate your own self-importance. And it takes a long time. There's a wall there. And it's kind of the selfishness just stays with you. And it's got to be dissipated. So the wall has to be broken down, and oftentimes through very unpleasant circumstances. You know, the blasted tower and the tarot, the falling tower of egotism. It crashes and you come crashing to earth, and you wake up wounded and maybe sadder but wiser and saying, well, that didn't work, and I have to go ahead caring more about others than about my own self-aggrandizement. So selfishness is hard to defeat. So what is your motive in life? Do you want to be number one? Do you want to step on others so you can be the king, the queen? Your words will reveal that, how you use words, how you think. And so we actually, what is my motive in life? Am I building myself up? There are so many people at the personal stage, you know, they have to have self-esteem. And if other people won't give it because of your merit, you kind of demand it and tell them how great you are. It's different from how great thou art. So what really is your motive? See it. And when you speak, let the words blend what you are as a personality with something bigger, something more beautiful, something larger, something more capacious, inclusive. The large purpose of the will of God. Now, how many of us do that? We run off at the mouth and say all kinds of things. And is the consciousness there that God has a large purpose and my speech should accord with it somehow? It takes a lot of skill to find the word which accords with the large purpose of the will of God. And then even worse is that repulsive word of hate. What is it? Wicked hate. You know, the Black Lodge, place of endless death. It's hate, it's lust. It's ugly. So, you know, you can say hateful things and cruel things and, you know, oftentimes not to the person's face, but when you get with your friends or whatever, cruel speech. I'm remembering, it strikes me, there was this woman who was convicted of some crime. She was basically taking pictures with her cell phone of women in the locker room, and she took a picture of an older woman who obviously wasn't in very good shape, and she sarcastically said, well, that's something you just can't unsee. Really, very cruel. Paid for it. But it really is poison. And when you think it, you speak it to others, or speak it even directly to somebody, they're going to feel its spell. It's almost like a wicked magic, and it ruins those. It just doesn't just hurt, it ruins. Ruin is a massacre of the whole system. The difference between people who've been raised by cruel parents, always criticizing them, and those who have been raised by supportive parents. So you know how it is when you hear something awful about yourself, which just isn't true, let's say, and the motive behind it is not constructive at all. It's to put you down. It's to take away from you, to reduce you to whatever, some very low state. And it's poison. Gossip, You can just see when Mars is in Gemini, how that speech could degenerate between people as they discuss someone else. Not helpfully, not constructively, but in a way which puts the other person down. Poisonous gossip passed along because it gives the thrill. Why a thrill? Because it lifts you. You're better and they're worse. And every time that lower ego gets that shot of I am better, I'm better and better, it just is thrilling in a kind of destructive way. It's the, people, they even kill people for thrills. Thrill kill, It emphasizes you, your power. You are powerful and they are nothing. And you take away their power, killing them. It's passed along because it gives a thrill. Did you hear what I heard? These words, the soul is trying to come through. It's not so easy getting through all that stuff. It's not even easy getting into the personality, the average personality. These words kill the flickering impulses of the soul. So just kill, not even just block out, but they just die. Cut at the roots of life. Life is a great thing, but you're cutting yourself off entirely, and that's really what the Black Lodge does. And the Lords of Form, they take away from whomever they discuss. Respect is not common unless the person is a great danger, Already respect is a sign of some kind of positivity. But life is trying to sustain you. But the words, like I remember pulling out weeds when I was a kid, and there's such a thing as it's a forked metal piece. It's a weed cutter, maybe. And you go underneath and you cut the root low, low, low down so that it has a tough time growing back. And the plant cannot grow back and life cannot enter. And so bring death because you're nourished from above. And the soul, where there's the flow of soul life, you're going to be healthy in all kinds of ways. And where there is not, you're going to be unhealthy, even dead in terms of your consciousness, and maybe physically dead too. I guess the words we speak can kill us as well as kill others. So we're dealing with poison here, with cruelty. It's one of the pride, separativeness, and cruelty. It's the ninth head of the Hydra and the third head, the mental part of the Hydra. and it's a pretty heavy and high and powerful and ugly and against the law, really, against the good law. Now, when do you speak these things? I mean, you may think them, and that's bad enough. When? If spoken in the light of day, you insult somebody, just retribution will they bring. Well, you say something, in the old days, someone throws down a glove and challenges you to a duel. That's the just immediate retribution. The counteraction comes in the light. You just insult, and the reaction comes, and it will be retributive. I tell you about all the movies I saw, right? You know, but what was it? It was really good. It had John Malkovich in it and Glenn Close. And it was, again, all about the French court and the cruelty of the French court. And a letter had been written to a man telling about another man who was having an affair with his beloved. And the next scene you see is they're having a sword fight. It was a very immediate reaction. The letter had many falsehoods in it, but to aggravate the one who received it. So there were lies, but there were also elements of truth there. And it was done cruelly, always. And immediately the response came. If spoken in the light of day, just retribution will they bring. When spoken, these cruel words, and registered as lies, because so many cruel things said have nothing to do with the truth. We lie about people, you know, and there's a lot of that going on right now, just insulting good people, even, you know, lying about them. And everybody knows it's a lie. Then they strengthen the illusory world in which the speaker lives and hold him back from liberation. So when we lie, we build a prison around ourselves, a prison of illusion, of false thought, and the other thoughts that are false within our minds are strengthened by the new false thought. It said the devil is the father of lies. The devil is the sort of negative three or fourfold personality. So lying holds us back. You can't imagine approaching the initiator, who is relatively truth itself, with a mind full of lies and the habit of speaking them out, causing disruption and disunity and distress. One cannot imagine such a thing. If uttered with intent to hurt, to bruise, to kill, as some people do, they really use the word as a weapon. And there was this movie, oh, forgive me, will you? But it was a marvelous movie about the court of France, which we know in the period of the French kings, the Black Lodge was active. Cosmic evil was active. And it was called Ridicule. Ridicule, you know, and I cannot tell you about how people treated each other in the French court and treated others. This was particular thing was in the court of Louis XVI, you know. He was with his Queen Marie Antoinette taken to the guillotine, and he was an ineffectual man, but all around him it was just like a nest of vipers, a pit, you know. And somehow the intellect and the satisfaction of taking others down through the tongue and what was said, it was so ugly to watch. And it was really a representation of blackness. And they uttered much with intent to hurt, to bruise, and kill. But these words are entities, and they wander back to him who sent them forth, and him they bruise and kill. So it's the boomerang, it's the turning around, it's the chickens coming home to roost, as they say. And you send, curses like chickens come home to roost. Do not wish evil upon the Blessed One, says Master Moria, because it's just going to bounce off the Blessed One and go right back to you. So there's a law operative here, and those who speak kindly and truthfully do not create prisons for themselves and help others and advance themselves. And those who waste the energy of speech through idle speech and build up their own self-importance through selfish thought, especially Ray 1 and 5, you know, they make themselves, as DK says, virtually untouchable, he says. And those who use the word as the destroyer will be destroyed by the word. So, you know, we take this to heart. Because he's speaking the truth here, and it may be a tough saying, but many of us have to adjust our behavior. I mean, you witness all kinds of bad behavior in public and among public figures and all that, and I guess we could spend a lot of time finding fault. But as DK says, that to know all is to understand all, you know. We can understand the psychological cause of it, and we can replace the negative, substitute the negative with the positive. It doesn't mean sending love to the Axis powers, as DK warned against, but it does mean emphasizing the positive possibilities in mankind, and they will replace the negativities we perceive. He goes on with the same theme, number 14, the idle thought, he summarizes, the selfish thought, the cruel, hateful thought, all of them, actually, if rendered into word, produce a prison, poison the springs of life, so we don't live in knowledge or consciousness, even in vitality, lead to disease and cause disaster and delay. And that's words. Now, he didn't say it's thoughts, but you can pretty well imagine that if we engage in this kind of thought, we're going to be speaking the words that are related to that quality of thought. Therefore, and maybe the first-rate types are just going to hate this, therefore be sweet and kind and good as far as in thee lies. Keep silence, the right kind of occult silence, as described in Raised and Initiations, and the light will enter in rather than be crowded out by the jungle of illusion and by the overgrowth and the tangle and all the festering conditions we have created through idle, selfish, and cruel, hateful thoughts. So the idle thought, the selfish thought, the cruel, hateful thought, bad enough on their own level of thinking, if rendered into word, become even more powerful on the outer plane and produce a prison which cuts us off from life and from the rejuvenating energy. Poison all the springs of life. We are dealing a lot with word and poison. Poisonous gossip. It's an ugly thing, and it really has to be avoided. Produce a prison, confinement, non-unity, non-oneness, death, non-livingness, poison. Where are you going to get your energy if it's all covered over with this rank and fetid growths and swamp that exists because of how we think and how we speak, and actually does lead to disease? I've sometimes wondered, you know, when you see these horrible diseases around the mouth and the tongue, and I wondered, you know, how has the individual spoken? I mean, maybe it's not even in this life, it's coming from another time. You know, you see some things and they're so pitiful, really, and you wonder what has caused them. But here we're told that cruel speech, selfish speech, causes disease and messes up all your intentions. So it can destroy your good intentions and at least delay you. So what's the alternative? You know, use Venus. Be attractive, be sweet, be kind, which means you understand your kinship with others, and we all go through it, and you don't separate yourself from others, but you, with solidarity, realize that you understand what they're passing through, and you have passed through it too, or will. And good, the beautiful, and the true, be good, which means conform to the archetype, which is set out by the purpose, as reflected in the plan. And good as far as in thee lies, because maybe, you know, you can't be perfectly good, perfectly kind, perfectly sweet, you know. Maybe there's a certain level that you can achieve and not more, but at least go as far as you can and keep the right kind of silence, which he explains in the rays and the initiations, rule 11. You know, it's really speaking appropriately and keeping a certain strata of speech to be directed towards others only in certain circumstances. So, in general, don't gossip. Don't take other people down through the cruelty of the tongue. Keep silence, which is not a suppressive thing, but, you know, sometimes there's the silence of understanding. The silence, yeah, I mean, really, in the silence, if we can refrain from having that immediate thought form response, we can understand. And basically, DK is saying, you know, to understand all is to forgive all. Keep silence, and the light of the soul or higher will enter in. Now we reach finally the 15th one. Speak not of self. Pity not thy fate. Thoughts of self and of thy lower destiny prevent the inner voice of thine own soul from striking upon thine ear. Speak of the soul, enlarge upon the plan. Forget thyself in building for the world. Thus is the law of form offset. Thus can the rule of love enter upon the world. Well, you know, speak not of self. I mean, some people are always talking about themselves. I sometimes try to use illustrations from my own life to make a point, an example. Master DK did that on occasion too, you know, if there's a lesson to be learned. But we do take our eyes off our little personal self, and we don't fall victim to self-pity, which is a real open door to glamour. Poor me, and look what I'm going through, and how tough it is. And there are many who have it much harder, you know. And every time one talks about the difficulty of one's life, one can only imagine that somewhere people are suffering far more So, you know, we are detached. We realize the instrument may suffer, but as DK said, what matters if the personality suffer? Just as long as some kind of lesson for the soul is learned. But if we're always thinking about the self and, oh, what's going to happen to me as a personality, and, you know, the usual astrological approach, how will I get money? Where will I live? Who's going to be my love interest? What's happening in my career? Will I live? Will I die? You know, all these questions that have to do with the lower interpretation of the houses of the horoscope, they concentrate the consciousness too low. Instead, speak of the soul and of the consciousness we all share, of the higher consciousness, which is unitive, inclusive, and helpful to everybody, and enlarge upon the plan. I mean, so many are walking around without the slightest idea that there is a plan and where it's all supposed to go, and then how in the world will they cooperate if they don't know that? And forget thy lower self, thy little self, in the next building project, according to the ashram. Something's being built up for the new civilization, and we have to care more about that than poor me, you know. Oh boy, I'm having a tough time. So there are larger things to which to address the flow of one's energy. And thus, form will lose its grip upon you. The law of form you will evade. You will free yourself from all of the conditions of form and eventually be above form, eventually be a master of form. And the third aspect will be offset, and the second aspect, the rule of love, can enter upon that world, the world of your own making, the world in which your consciousness, to which your consciousness directs you, and the world upon which your consciousness is focused. Speak not of self, pity not thy fate, the thoughts of self and of thy lower destiny prevent the inner voice of thine own soul from striking upon thine ear. You're so concentrated below that the still small voice is drowned out by all of the voices which are moving towards the satisfaction of your personal objectives. Instead, speak of the soul, enlarge upon the plan. Try to make it clear to yourself and others, obviously, and forget thy little self. Take thine eyes off thy little self. Forget thyself in building for the world, and thus for everybody, and thus for humanity, and thus for the planet. Thus is the law of form which holds you captive in form offset, and thus can the rule of love, which is not yet ruling, enter upon the world. Well, you know, every once in a while, friends, just repeat those things to yourself. Read through them, memorize them, maybe. They're very beautiful and very wise. Simple rules, says DK, and I call them wise counsels. And these simple rules, there again, will lay right foundations. Because, you know, we start to practice them in early days. For carrying forward the magical work, how else will you create if you're filled with hate and selfishness and filth and all the rest of it? Carrying forward the magical work and will render the mental body so clear, so powerful, that right motive will control and true work in building will be possible, not just work that will have to be undone by someone else who comes along and knows more and sees how you have misbuilt, you know. So if the mind is clear, you'll be able to see where things lead, and you will adopt right motive because you'll see the futility. You'll know logically the futility of other ways of being. Okay, well, I'm going to, after 2.5 hours here, and maybe slurring my words a little bit, hopefully not so the thought didn't come through, call it a day, an evening, a night. And there's a little more to say about it, but it'll be a good bridge when we start again. Just reading these simple rules, these counsels again, I'm reminded of how really powerful they are. And it's 470 to 475, I believe. Are we at 475? Four something. We're on 475. Okay, and this is not the 15th. Well, actually, it ended on the 17th, and it's beginning, hopefully tomorrow, hopefully the 17th. And it's going to begin with number 58. 58 programs already in the Rules for the Astral Plane. I guess the book, you know, is a book on the control of the astral body, basically. And that's the vehicle in which so many people are focused, and that's the one unified vehicle. It doesn't have that dotted line. It doesn't have that split, as it were. And we'll start on 475. As a matter of fact, I have to put this where it really belongs because we really went up to this point. Okay, but it's correct. And hopefully tomorrow I can do something on this. And this was the end of 11.4. So, and now we're ready to start the fifth program on Rule 11. And we're at 475, which means we're about 34 pages from the end of this. And then I'm going to sort of stop for a while because the rules for work on the astral plane will be completed and, you know, let you know about it and distributed, and then when I have more time, I'm going to get into the last four rules, 12, 13, 14, 15, for the etheric plane and its relation to the physical plane where the precipitation must occur. Well, we have wonderful stuff and deep wisdom being conveyed to us, and hopefully we really somehow record this wisdom and that it comes to our aid and to our rescue at times when it is needed. Hopefully that is the way it works out. So, many blessings, lots of love, and study hard. See you later.